This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Two grants were submitted this week that, if funded, will support the digitizing of thousands of reel-to-reel tapes from the vast KBOO archive. You can hear samples of these priceless audio recordings on two KBOO monthly programs, Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, and Treasures from the Archives. An emerging partnership with Portland Community Media will bring KBOO to television audiences. In-studio videotaping of program hosts, interviewees, and musicians will be broadcast on various cable channels. The first program to be featured will be Buscando America. Stay tuned for details on when you can watch KBOO on TV in the near future. Planning is about to begin for KBOO's 45th birthday party. If you would like to help and are excited about fundraising, sponsorships, marketing, and coordinating major events, please come to the development meeting February 4th, 6 p.m. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch at 503-231-8032 or navigator at kboo.org. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Portland premiere of Who Bombed Judy Berry at the Clinton Street Theater, Wednesday, February 13th. The film will play at both 7 p.m. and 9:15. This new documentary covers the 1990 bomb attack on two Northern California environmental activists, which still remains unsolved. The film is a compelling tribute to Berry, a fiery speaker whose background as a union organizer put her in a unique position to bridge the cultural divide between forest activists and rank-and-file loggers.
I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe.
Again, that's Wednesday, February 13th at the Clinton Street Theater. More information may be found at kboo.fm/Berry2013.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News...
City workers gather in downtown Portland for a Tuesday rally against proposed cuts to municipal workers.
KBOO calls the state's legislative revenue office to learn where Oregon gets most of its state taxes from.
A leaked memo lays out the Obama administration policy for targeted drone assassinations. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 5th, 2013. I'm Don Merrill.
And I'm Ren Green. This morning, Portland city workers rallied downtown in front of the Portland building in protest of Mayor Charlie Hales' proposed cuts to municipal workers. While Hales is proposing to cut the jobs of many workers, he has not included any cuts to managerial positions. KBOO's Jamie Partridge attended the rally and spoke to Mike Darfler, a member of the DCTU, the District Coalition of Trade Unions. The DCTU is a coalition of seven different trade unions that bargain collectively with the city of Portland and were well represented at this morning's rally. For more on the story, here's Jamie Partridge reporting from downtown Portland.
50 folks out here on this soggy February day in front of the Portland building. The city is not ready to kick off bargaining. These workers clearly are. Laborers 483. Electricians, Jobs with Justice, AFSCME, District Council of Trade Unions. All right, so what is this rally about today, Mike?
This rally is about bargaining. We're kicking off our bargaining. We're here to say we're ready to bargain. We're here to tell the citizens of the city of Portland that we're ready to stand up and protect our jobs so we can protect the services that they rely on.
So tell us about the services that these 1,600, is that right, 1,600 workers from the city of Portland, what kind of services do they provide?
Wow, that's a great question. We provide everything from clean drinking water to, when you're done with the drinking water, make it sure it goes to the treatment plant instead of the Willamette River. We provide public safety infrastructure services for police, fire, and EMS. Anytime they go on a call and receive a radio transmission, it's because of a DCTU worker. We make sure that people that are arrested are not wanted in other states to protect the public safety, which, in my opinion, is the frontline biggest responsibility of a city is public safety.
So it's parks, water, the roads, all that. The DCTU is one of the oldest bargaining contracts that the city of Portland has. Is that right?
That is correct. And yes, we do all the parks. We keep the parks clean. We keep the water flowing. We keep the potholes filled. We keep the video flowing. We do any frontline service for the city of Portland is primarily done by the members of the DCTU.
I understand that Mayor Hales has directed his bureaus to come up with a budget that includes a 10% cut across the board.
That is correct. A 10% cut can be devastating to the members of this union.
Well, the mayor says their money isn't there. So where do you think the money's going to come from if the mayor says it's not there?
I think they can look to some of the overhead. I think that we should prioritize the frontline services and look to cut some overhead.
Thank everybody for showing up on an iffy February day like today.
It's raining out here, folks.
My name is Mary Proxman. I work for the city of Portland. I actually work as a non-sworn member at the police bureau. And as you all know, we are going into bargaining. The city has already canceled the first two bargaining sessions. They need to prepare, which you know, it's not a bad thing for them to come to the table prepared. We don't want to waste our time. We don't want them to waste their time, you know. These are taxpayer dollars, and these are tight budget times. And that also being said, you know, we're all in this together. So there's no time like the present to come together. The DCTU is fundamentally a union made up of, what, seven different unions? Union, united, will never be defeated. Union, united.
About.
Because 3 years ago they said they had hard times and they needed to make a lot of budget adjustments. And we told them the first thing you ought to do is lay off some of this bloated management. We have a study that says they got way more managers and they pay them way more than any other city on the West Coast. So we deliver the message already to Mayor Hales. When you start to cut, you cut the people that don't do the work. There's something called direct labor and something called indirect labor. We're all direct labor. We produce work. Mayor Hales said he cut part of his team. He cut some of the mayor's staff. That's a good first step.
Yes.
Furthermore, we told them, you look at some of the contracts that you have, and you quit just rubber stamping contracting out. If they had done those two things 3 years ago, they wouldn't have an $8 million hole or a $20 million hole. They'd have extra money right now. This is a city that not only won't cut the managers, they won't cut the bad managers. Let's tell it like it is. Right now in the police bureau, there's a manager that sexually harassed one of our members, harassed and bullied one of our stewards, and he didn't get fired. He got moved so he could harass somebody else.
Ken Allen, executive director of AFSCME Council 75, that's Oregon. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Jamie Partridge, KBU News.
That was Jamie Partridge reporting from today's City Workers Rally.
The newest Portland City Commissioner, Steve Novick, has called on state officials to delay the covering of Portland's water reservoirs by at least another 4 years. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency ordered all cities to cover their own open reservoirs, even cities like Portland that have pristine water supplies. Dana Haynes with the Office of Mayor Charlie Hales spoke with KBU today about Commissioner Novick's request.
Earlier this week, I think yesterday or early today, the commissioner shared a letter that he was going to send with the mayor, and the mayor saw that, agreed that was a good idea. We probably do need to slow down. We probably do need more information. For instance, both Commissioner Novick and the mayor are brand new to their jobs, and you know they need some time to catch their breath and get some data. So the commissioner was asking for a bit of a delay on the covered reservoirs. The mayor saw that letter in advance and agreed that was a good idea. Other states have requested delays. Other cities have requested delays. Some have been successful. Some have not. There was a city in New York that wanted a delay on theirs, and they got one so they could do some time to do some more research. Before this city commission was formed in January, and remember, we have two of the five members are brand new, apparently they had asked the state, can we slow down? The state had said no, and now the new commission is asking again, figuring what's the worst they can do. The state can say, no, we still don't think you can slow down. No, you still don't have more time to get up to speed on this issue. Or they can say, yeah, you know, that's reasonable. Take the time to do the research. We are the commissioner for the Bureau of Water. That has been true for almost 24 hours now. So I won't pretend that we are as up to speed as the other four commissioners are on a myriad of issues, and this is one of them.
That was Dana Haynes with the office of Mayor Charlie Hales. Mayor Hales has temporarily taken over all city bureaus for the next 3 months to determine where to make cuts.
The director of the Clackamas County Housing Authority resigned Monday over improper management of affordable housing. Trell Anderson and his agency drew scrutiny after the Housing Authority failed to fix water and mold damage at Clackamas' Easton Ridge Affordable Housing Complex. Easton Ridge residents have complained about health problems stemming from the mold since 2005. Easton Ridge is the largest affordable housing complex in Clackamas with 264 units. It will cost $42 million to repair the complex. The Housing Authority also wasted $600,000 after making an error on a federal grant application. Anderson makes over $150,000 a year. The Housing Authority will undergo a performance audit in the coming months.
A Gresham bakery is being investigated after refusing to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. The complaint claims that one of the owners of Sweet Cakes Bakery declined to make the cake for the couple and called them an abomination unto the Lord. Aaron Klein, the co-owner of Sweet Cakes Bakery, denied that he called the couple an abomination, but admitted that he had refused their business because they were a same-sex couple. Oregon law prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation, but Klein believes that he is protected by the United States Constitution. Klein defended his actions as an expression of religious freedom and claimed that he had received phone calls of support from all over the country. But he is also receiving letters and calls challenging his interpretation of Scripture. One local gay couple even set up a free cupcake stand as a protest across the street from the bakery this past weekend, calling their protest Cupcakes for Equality.
With the annual Yard, Garden, and Patio show slated for this weekend, a large banner targeting one of the show's sponsors was seen today in southeast Portland. The large banner with the words, quote, "Shame on Dennis 7Ds," unquote, was on full display in front of their garden center on Southeast Powell and 61st. The banner was held by members of the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, who is involved in a lengthy labor dispute with a contractor tied to 7Ds and the gardening show. The contractor, DWA Trade Show and Exposition Services, was selected to assemble trade show booths for this weekend's show, which will take place at the convention center. According to the Carpenters Union, DWA fails to pay a fair wage with benefits. The union is pressuring the Oregon Association of Nurseries and its members like Dennis 7Ds to use a contractor that meets area labor standards or pressure DWA to do the same. For more on this story, KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with Carpenters Union representative Ben Basem.
Ben, can you tell me more about this labor dispute with the DWA and how long it's been going on?
The dispute with DWA has been going on now for about 15 years. They're a contractor that pays significantly lower than the area standard wage for trade show workers in the area. I think right around now they're anywhere in the range of $12 to $18 an hour, very minimal health care, whereas the area standard wage benefit package is about a $37 an hour total package for trade show workers in Portland. You know, we feel that companies like DWA coming in and undercutting wage and benefit packages basically creates a downward spiral for wages and just hurts all carpenters in the area.
Can you talk about the connection between this local garden chain and DWA?
So for the Yard, Garden, and Patio show, the Oregon Association of Nurseries is the major sponsor, of which Dennis in 7Ds is a member of that association. You know, we feel that all the association members, including the umbrella group, the Oregon Association of Nurseries, has an obligation to the community to make sure that area labor standards are met for their trade shows.
This flyer that I got today, at the bottom it says, you are not urging any worker to refuse to work, nor are you urging any supplier to refuse to deliver goods. Has there been anything done other than just an informational campaign?
There's been other actions against DWA themselves in the forms of, you know, picket action, things like that. But those have been quite some time ago. Lately, it's been mostly just these public information campaigns with our large banner displays or handbills.
Why not picket?
It's kind of a choice we've made as far as what got the message out there more effectively. You know, we feel that these kind of banners and handbills reach a lot more people and engage a lot more of the public than a picket would.
Is the union currently under any sort of negotiations with DWA or maybe the OAN in a larger context?
We've talked to different people at the Oregon Association of Nurseries, just mainly regarding our dispute with DWA. We haven't really talked to DWA management much. You know, our issue with DWA is strictly over their, you know, their wage standards. You know, we're not trying to organize them. We're not trying to make them become a signatory contractor in any way. We just want to see them pay their workers what they deserve to be making and fine with health care and pension.
I've been speaking with Ben Basem, a representative with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. This is Rebecca Ney with KBU News.
Robert Keyes is a temporary postal employee who has been doing the work of a full-time employee for 5 years. KBOO's Jamie Partridge talked with Mr. Keyes about the life of a transitional employee.
I was a RCA, which is a rural carrier associate, and I was told at the time that being a transitional employee or a TE was a faster way to career, that when the contract was negotiated and finished, that I would be bumped into my career position. So, you know, I believed and took a leap.
But in these 5 years, you've been without health insurance, without sick pay, without vacation.
In these 5 years, I've been without everything.
Except you've been doing the same job as a regular career letter carrier, and even more, working 6 days a week, 10 hours a day.
10 hours if I'm lucky. I'm casing two routes, maybe splitting a second route. Carrying sometimes up to 3 hours of another route. You know, when you're a TE, say goodbye to anything that can't happen on Sunday.
Because Sunday's the only day that you have off.
Yeah, if you're lucky, you know, this Christmas, they tried to take Sundays too for parcel delivery, and it was mandatory for TEs. It's a 5-year job interview with the angle being that they want to, you know, work you to death and then throw you in the garbage.
So something recently has happened with this, a new labor contract has been handed down by an arbitrator, which changes the TE, the transitional employee job, to a city carrier assistant, CCA. And now you're going to have to become a CCA, and what does that mean for you?
Well, what it means is that my 5 years don't matter. I get my Christmas bonus was to wake up and be told, here's your chance at a career. It's going to cost you 25% of your income, and whatever you did before doesn't matter. They make you take the test. They put you in any order. They don't even recognize you for your service.
So you're taking a 25% pay cut, plus you have to take a test, which you may not pass.
How can you sell that to people? We have a long history. The post office has a long history. It's not a job. You know, it's a calling. When Hurricane Sandy hit, there were carriers. They donated their vacation to go down and help deliver the mail. We pick up food every year. Post offices.
These people are taking a big pay cut. Plus, Congress is talking about possibly taking 1 day of delivery, moving from 6 day to 5 day delivery. And what impact will that have on these new city carrier assistants?
They're going to be gone. Somehow they transformed the goal into we're a corporation.
So I'd like to just remind our listeners that the Postal Service is under attack, and these transitional employees, now city carrier assistants, are in the crosshairs. What can our listeners do to help out?
Well, we can agitate. I mean, we can. There's a TE forum that's going to be on President's Day, 5:30 at the Branch Union Hall on 42nd and Killingsworth. You know, call. Make some noise. That's important. You know, it's not all about money. It's not all about money. We're not asking for anything we haven't earned, and we don't expect to. You know, we're just asking for what we're not asking. We're expecting that the post office is going to wake up and do the right thing and pay, give us wages commensurate to our experience, to our efforts.
That was Robert Keyes, a temporary postal employee, talking with KBOO's Jimmy Partridge about how conditions for dedicated postal workers have deteriorated. For those interested, there will be a rally for workers and the Postal Workers Union on March 17th at 2 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square.
Students, teachers, parents, and community members across the country are encouraged to scrap the map tomorrow and take a stand against standardized testing. The measure of academic progress test was scheduled to be administered this morning in Seattle, despite nearly 100 students having been excused from the exam, according to the Seattle Times. Boycotts for the test began in January in a unanimous decision by Seattle educators to protest a test with scores that are typically used in teacher evaluations, despite lacking alignment with state teaching standards, amongst other complaints. CommonDreams.org reports that the Seattle Educators Association, in conjunction with solidarity group Scrap the Map and the local chapter of the NAACP, is calling on fellow instructors, parents, students, and other sympathizers to show their support by holding rallies, meetings, taking photos, and wearing red. Portland Public Schools and Portland Student Unions are joining the nationwide effort and holding a joint press conference to highlight both organizations' opt-out campaign, encouraging Oregon students to opt out of taking their State Oaks tests. The conference is scheduled to take place at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning in front of the Blanchard Education Service Center.
There he is, there he is, that man keeps me up at night. Oh gee whiz, that's why I can't eat a bite. Look at those.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. At 6, it's Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show. Tonight, we welcome local organizers from 1 Billion Rising, an international day of action to end violence against women happening on February 14th. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's show continues the celebration of Black history with a special guest, Carter G. Woodson, Black History Bowl, as well as a discussion on ending community violence. Tomorrow's weather will be a 70% chance of rain with a high of 47 degrees.
That man's perfection. I repeat, don't you think he's kind of neat? And I ask you very
kindly. It's 5:24. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
4 years ago, Michelle Obama picked up a shovel to make a powerful symbolic statement about America's food and farm future. She turned a patch of White House lawn into a working organic garden. So I'm guessing that now, as she begins another 4 years in the People's Mansion, the First Lady is asking herself, what next? What can I do this time around to plant a crop of common sense in our country's political soil that will link America's farmers, consumers, environment, and grassroots economy into one big harvest of common good? Thanks for asking, and I'm happy to offer a one-word answer to your query. Hemp. Plant a good, healthy stand of industrial hemp next to your organic garden. Yes, hemp is a distant cousin of marijuana, though the industrial variety of cannabis lacks the psychoactive punch of pot. Industrial hemp won't make anyone high, but it certainly can make us happy, because it would deliver a new economic and environmental high for America. Our nation is the world's biggest consumer of hemp products, from rope to shampoo, building materials to food. Yet the mad masters of our insane drug war have lumped hemp and marijuana together as Schedule I controlled substances, making our land of the free the world's only industrialized country that bans farmers from growing this benign, profitable, job-creating, and environmentally beneficial plant. This is Jim Hightower saying, as Michael Bowman, a Colorado farmer, so aptly asks, can we just stop being stupid? He's one of the leaders of a national bipartisan movement to legalize hemp production. As one small step, He's seeking 100,000 signatures on a White House petition that simply asks President Obama to include the words industrial hemp in his February 12th State of the Union speech. To sign the petition, go to this website, petitions.whitehouse.gov.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Oregon gets two-thirds of its revenue from personal income tax. That's almost 22% more than the next two states that also rely on personal income tax for most of their revenue. I spoke with Chris Alanek, Legislative Revenue Office Communications Officer, to learn more.
How is it that Oregon came to rely so heavily on personal income tax as a revenue source?
Well, we don't have a sales tax, and there is no statewide property tax. So the in terms of the three major taxes, income taxes, property taxes, and sales tax, we just have the income tax.
Right, and I got that from the article, but I'm just curious to know, how is it that did voters over the years just vote down sales taxes? Was there no real effort to increase corporate taxes? I'm just kind of curious of how it came to be this way.
Initially, the income tax was used as a replacement for a state property tax. This was back in around 1930, and that was voted down and replaced with the income tax. And so we've had that since about 1930. And the sales tax has been on the ballots about nine times over the years and has been defeated every time.
I'm just curious to know, Oregon is the home of a lot of Fortune 500 companies. I mean, has there been any move ever to increase corporate income tax rates?
The issue of the corporate taxation has always been there in terms of some people wanting to increase the tax liability. And actually, in 2010, there were Measure 66 and Measure 67. Measure 67 did increase the corporate excess tax. It instituted a larger minimum tax. The minimum tax went from $10 per corporation to a sliding scale of $150,000 to $100,000. And the tax rate, there was a new top marginal tax rate created. Prior to Measure 67, corporate taxes were just a flat 6.6%. And then what we have now is a top rate of 7.6% for income over $10 million. So we now have a two-rate structure.
I'm just curious how often state tax policies are reviewed to decide whether or not they're equitable and meeting the state's needs. Is it on a fiscal year basis, a calendar year basis, every 2 years?
Well, the legislature does look at them every session. There are different bills to approach those issues of equity, fairness, adequacy. Right now, the focus tends to be on this session. It looks like it's going to be on tax expenditures. Basically deductions and credits that reduce tax. One of the challenges for the legislature is that any bill that raises taxes that is deemed to be a revenue raiser requires the three-fifths vote in each chamber to make it through the legislature before being sent on to the governor. So that bar, that's a little bit higher. It's more than a simple majority.
That was Oregon Legislative Revenue Office Communications Officer Chris Alanek talking about why Oregon gets so much of its revenue from personal income tax.
The U.S. government filed a $5 billion civil suit against Standard & Poor's Monday, marking the first legal action taken against a credit rating service in connection with the financial crisis 5 years ago. The lawsuit accuses the firm of defrauding investors from 2004 to 2007. According to the lawsuit, ratings assigned to the mortgage-backed securities were inflated and the risks associated with them understated. Other ratings institutions like Moody's and Fitch were not included in the lawsuit despite the fact that they engaged in many of the same practices. Several states followed the federal government in filing their own lawsuits against Standard & Poor's, including California, which is seeking $4 billion in damages for fraud which left many elderly people without pensions. The lawsuit was brought under the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act, which was passed in the wake of the 1980s savings and loan scandal. The law has been used very little by the U.S. Justice Department since it was passed in 1989, even though it has a very low burden of proof and provides broad investigative powers to charge banks engaged in illegal activity.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation is urging the Supreme Court to block the collection of DNA from everyone arrested for a crime. The EFF says in a recent amicus brief that law enforcement needs a warrant before forcing people to give genetic samples. The case, Maryland versus King, challenges a law in the state of Maryland requiring DNA collection from all arrestees, whether they are ultimately convicted of a crime or not. The EFF points out that it's against the Fourth Amendment to retain DNA samples and repeatedly search them in case the owner was involved in other crimes. John Gallivan talked with Jennifer Lynch, staff attorney at the EFF, about the case and what happens to DNA records.
We'll get back. We'll return to that.
We'll return to that story. That was Jennifer Lynch. We'll be hearing from Jennifer Lynch.
On Monday, the City Council of Charlottesville, Virginia, passed what is believed to be the first anti-drone resolution in the country. The resolution calls for a 2-year moratorium of drones in the state of Virginia, stating they pose a serious threat to privacy and constitutional rights. The City Council of Charlottesville is also calling on the United States Congress to ban information obtained by drones being used in federal and state court. Lawmakers in at least 11 states are looking into plans to restrict the use of drones over their skies. The action comes after concerns that the unmanned aerial vehicles could be exploited to spy on Americans. PBS recently aired an episode revealing new technology that crosses into the realm of science fiction with the level of surveillance it allows. The invention, named Argus, is the world's most high-resolution camera. At 17,000 feet, it can take a live-action stream of 15 square miles of a city. Argus saves all footage, 1 million terabytes of video a day, allowing all outside activities to be taped and saved for viewing at a later time. State legislators in several U.S. states are also proposing some restrictions on the new technology. A new bill currently making its way through Oregon's state Senate would establish Oregon's own airspace, regulated at the state level, to try to control drone use by federal agencies and private citizens. But the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation says it's not that simple because the FAA controls all airspace in the country. If passed, any drone activity over Oregon air would have to register with the